Call a meeting to order. This is State Government Finance Committee meeting for Tuesday, March 15th, 2011. And let's see, I think we have a quorum, so would someone move the minutes? Representative Benson moves the minutes from yesterday. All in favor, any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The minutes are approved. We have a number of presentations here this morning. And first of all, we have the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council representative. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourselves for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Anna Marie Hill Kleinhans, and I'm the Executive Director of Indian Affairs.
My name is Jolynn Shaftes. I'm the Legislative and Grants Director for the Indian Affairs Council.
You may proceed.
Mr. Chairman, if we have your permission, we have a brief presentation on PowerPoint that we can show you.
Okay.
That explains our agency to all of you. Time, I'm open. If you have any questions at any time, feel free to stop me and ask me. Okay, the very beginning about us. We were established in 1963, and the Minnesota Indian Affairs is a liaison between the state of Minnesota and the 11 tribal governments within the state. We were the second in the nation to create such a department. The first was South Dakota, and others followed the model that we created, and we are leaping out here. I do have it in front of me here, so I can just continue until she gets that up and going. The council provides a forum for and advises state government on issues of concern to the American Indian community of the entire state of Minnesota. Next, the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council plays a central role in the development of state legislation. The next slide, please. Resulting from monitoring programs that affect the state's American Indian population and tribal governments. The Minnesota Indian Affairs Council is the largest board, one of the largest boards in the nation as well. It consists of the 11 tribal chairs or their designee. Participation in the Indian Affairs Council is an optional participation, and it is written that way in the statute. There's a member of the governor's official staff, and as you see, the a lot of commissioners on there: education, natural resources, deed, Minnesota Housing Finance, Veterans Affairs, Commissioner of Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation, Administration, Human Services, Human Rights, Corrections, Health, Transportation. The newest commissioner to the list was the past 2 years, and that's the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs, asked to be added to the Indian Affairs Council. There's also two members from the House of Representatives, two members from the Senate. We're currently waiting for a Senate appointment. Senator Mary Olson is to be replaced. She was on the committee last year. You have in front of you a map of the 11 reservations in the state of Minnesota that just gives you a nice visual where everybody's located. The following page is our vision and our mission. The vision, which was developed in the very beginning, is to strive for social, economic, and political justice for all American Indian people living in the state of Minnesota while embracing our traditional, cultural, and spiritual values. The mission is to protect sovereignty of the 11 Minnesota tribes and ensure the well-being of American Indian citizens throughout the state of Minnesota. Here is the composition of our agency. Myself, the executive director, and I'm located here in St. Paul, right across the street. And we also have below is my business manager, who is the OEO Tribal Liaison. That's Office of Economic Opportunity Tribal Liaison. That's Diana. And that is funded primarily through a federal grant that has been a revolving federal grant for upwards of about 30 years into the department. And that's a $60,000 grant that funds her position to do work with the tribal governments on economic opportunity. And Cultural Resource Director Jim Jones, and I'll get into more of what the Cultural Resources Department does in a bit. The Legislative and the Indigenous Language or Grant Director is Jolynn Shaptees, and she's to my right. And then we below we have a Cultural Resources Assistant, that's Pete Palma, and a Cultural Resources Assistant, Tom Ross. We have some official duties of the Council, and I will not go through those word by word. You can see what they are, and I believe that each of you might have a PowerPoint also in front of you that you had a copy made for you, and you can see these. But these are listed in the statute as well. We analyze and make recommendations to tribal elected leaders and to members of the legislature and the governor on legislation and information on programs, proposals, and projects of importance to tribal governments and non-tribal Indian organization. And this, I must say, takes up about the majority of the time that we do, and we are continually working on issues of policy and public policy and things that will affect or better the tribes and the tribal communities in the state of Minnesota. We assist in establishing Indian advisory councils. We assist state agency in defining what groups, organizations, committees, councils, or individuals are eligible for delivery of services. We assist in ensuring the provision of resources and the delivery of service. We recommend to tribal governments and state government the means to enhance the delivery of services. Can you scroll to the next? Number six, we assist state agencies in implementing and updating studies of services. Number seven, we provide for the benefit of all levels of state government a continuing liaison between state governmental bodies and elected tribal leaders. And I must say that is also a very, very, very big and important part of what we do as well. Eight, interact with private organizations involved with Indian people that develop and implement a program to programs to assist Indian people when such programs may affect state agencies and departments. Nine, develop educational programs, community organization programs, leadership development programs, motivational programs, business development programs for Indian persons who have been, are, or may be subject to prejudice and discrimination. Economic development is very important. 10, review data provided by the Commissioner of Human Resources on the welfare of children and present recommendation to elected tribal leaders on out-of-home placement of Indian children. And 11, prepare for proposed agenda for the annual summit of elected tribal leaders, legislative leaders, and the governor. And number 11 is the newest that was created about 4 years ago, where we had put into statute that every year the tribal leaders were to meet with the governor and discuss the most critical issues affecting American Indian people in the state of Minnesota. Our key areas of activity, those are broken down by areas of activity within. We're so small that we don't have set departments and a whole bunch of people underneath those departments, but we do have key areas of activity. Legislative and community outreach is one of those. Dakota and Ojibwe Language Revitalization Grant Program is another, and it's a big part of what we do, and that was added last biennium thanks to the Legacy Committee and the funding of a very, very important initiative in Indian country, which is revitalizing two languages that are becoming extinct. Number three, we have a cultural resources or reburial program. And number four, we have the Office of Economic Opportunity or the Human Services Grant Outreach Program. Here's our budget information, which I must say is very hard for me to read here. Each of you have that in front of you, our budget information. And as you can see, the current fiscal year, and I'll just be very, very brief, and we can go through this more at length later if you choose or if you have any questions pertaining to the budget. And unfortunately, if I stumble over any of the budget quick answers, I've got budget people here I see in the audience, which is the smart people from the Department of Administration who assist me in the finances and who do an excellent job of assisting Indian Affairs in following all the policies and laws that apply to handling money in the office. Fiscal year 2011, our current appropriation is $491,486,000 for 2011. Arts and cultural funding, you see $950,000, and that's mainly for grants to go out to the communities, as well as a working group that was taking a look at how do we revitalize the languages in the state of Minnesota. There will be a report that's presented to the Legacy Committee soon. Expenditures by a direct appropriation, you can see that those are the figures to the higher appropriation in 2011 is a carryover from 2010, and that had a lot to do with the fact that we had lost one of our employees, not entirely, but he went on short-term disability and then on long-term disability. He had a terminal illness, liver cancer, but I need to report that he's back well, and he's had a transplant, and he's back with us now. And we're very grateful to have him. And if any of you have met him, his name is Pete Palma. You would feel honored to know Pete Palma. He's an inspiration, and we love him dearly. But we had an absence of a person in there for a while, and then we replaced him, and now we have two wonderful people there for the time being. We also have a federal grant that shows up there, and we also have additional money that was brought in through an MHS grant and another federal grant to assist in the Cultural Resources Department. And then the expenses are broken down by category and by fund, total operating fund. And then we have a positions that you see 5.1 for the current for 2010, 6.1 for 2011. That 0.1 is budgeted part-time staff that we budgeted for. If you go over to fiscal year 2013, it's figures that are pretty straight up, and they show what the current governor's recommendations are, which is $486,000 a year. That's what the governor has recommended. And at this point in the presentation is the Language Revitalization Program, and I will let my language grant director speak on that one just briefly.
Thank you. Before we move on, Representative Leidiger has a question, and then members, we've allotted about 15 minutes for each of these, so we have another 5 minutes. Representative Leidiger.
Is it all right if I just wait till the end of her brief and then I...
Okay. Ms. Shoptees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our language revitalization program is funded from the Legacy Division, and the appropriations are before you. We were given an additional document as well that goes over the language program in depth, so I'll kind of leave that information for you. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them at the end for you.
Thank you.
Just on briefly, since I only have 5 more minutes, Cultural Resources Program, I wish I had my Cultural Resources Director here to present to you. There is a Minnesota Statutes 30708 Private Cemeteries Act that explains in full how we work with human remains or burials found outside of recorded cemeteries. And it explains here exactly briefly what they do. There's a whole lot more work than just what the statute describes, but basically they have to identify the human remains, they have to identify the burials found outside of recorded cemeteries or unplatted graves or burials found within recorded cemeteries and in contexts which indicate antiquity greater than 50 years shall be dealt with according to the provisions of this section. If they're greater than 50 years, then they have to be dealt with the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council in identifying where those remains came from. And there's a big process, a long process, and it requires an archaeologist, anthropologists to work on the identification of the human remains, and that's what our Cultural Resources Department is heavily involved in doing. And what can happen in site excavation, and some of you may know this personally by building your own home or building businesses in the state of Minnesota, is that frequently they dig up human remains or bones, skeletal remains, or grave sites that are from long ago in the state of Minnesota. And at that point, the contractor is required to stop the moving forward with anything that he's doing or the development, and to contact certain authorities within the county and the state, and then the archaeologist gets involved if it's not identified as a concern for the BCA or if it's not a murder site or someone who's a missing victim, and then it just goes on down the line. Eventually, if it's over 50 years old, it makes its way to the Indian Affairs Department and it's dealt with here. And the construction site or the excavation has to stop until the identification or the reburial, the removal is handled correctly and those remains are reburied. And it can be a big process. The best person to speak on to that is the expert that's been doing it for upwards of 20 years, and that's my staff person, Jim Jones. and he is always available for further questions if you have those. We spend upwards of 50% of our budget goes towards that. This year, I calculated, next year it'll be upwards of 35% of that. That is a necessary part. And when I came 5 years ago, I identified this as a crucial need in budgeting for in our department, because there are people all over the state that run into this situation all the time. And I ran into it personally when I came here with a developer up in Detroit Lakes who called me and said that she had been working with us or waiting with us to get the excavation or to continue with the development, that she was doing a big development up there in Detroit Lakes. And one of the places had they had just massive amounts of skeletal remains that they could not do anything about. And until those are properly removed, then they can fix those. So it's been an area of critical importance to me and to the Indian Affairs Council. And it continues to be so. So, and for the benefit of all, we work very hard in that area, and we budget a fair amount for that. We can move to the next slide.
Ms. Hill, Kleinhaus, we need to
wrap it up.
Proceed here.
Okay.
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These are great programs. My main question, however, is why was the Indian Affairs Council started back there in 1963?
That's a really good question, and I wish I would have had time to make a slideshow to give us a visual difference too, because that always helps me. It was developed at that time to handle some of the most critical issues in that day and time, and I can easily say that there were probably people, the majority of the people on the reservations or in the tribal communities were without electricity, were without plumbing, were without clean water, without the unemployment rate was probably upwards of what pops in my head is 90%. I'm no expert on that, because in some places it remains at 50 to 60% in the remote parts. And they came together to handle the most critical issues, to work together. And as you know, being leaders of the state of Minnesota, that the best way to solve problems is coming together as a collective whole and solving those problems. We still do that today.
Representative Leidiger.
I remember visiting the reservations in the 60s as a kid. And I remember they were poor. Yeah. And here's where I'm driving towards. Now, a lot of years have gone by. Gambling, of course, has been allowed on the reservations. There's a lot of money that's there. And do you ever see a day in which the council can get spun off where revenue comes from other sources to support the good work that you're doing? And I'm wondering whether, is there a path we can look at to get this to be a self-sustaining organization using private funds?
Sure.
Bill Kleinhaus.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, I did...
Leidiger's the name.
Representative Leidiger. That's a really good question, and I've thought long and hard about that question, too. But I do have a short answer to that. Well, sort of short, but we can talk about that another time. You know, there are so many things, and the state of Minnesota houses a lot of the American Indian people today, and I know that you were asking about the gaming and the gaming revenue and the success that we've seen. I think over the years, we've all increased in our successes and our prosperity, perhaps since 1963. Every single one of us have benefited, and a lot of the good developments or the innovations that have happened in the economy. But at the same time, the American Indian community has continued to go, as the state of Minnesota or people or those of us fortunate to live in areas that are perhaps more have accessible programs and programming. We've gone like this, and the tribes have continued to go like this. And that still holds true today. And I know that what we see in the gaming industry, and I'm very, very grateful for that was signed into law over 20-some years ago. What we see is that is one area of economic development, and only one. It's only one solution. It's like as if we were to put a clothing store into one community and say, gee, it's going to provide all these things and all these resources for everybody. It might be a very, very good thing and a wonderful thing that will spawn many other things. But 20 years isn't a whole lot of time for economic development. We're still going like that. That's why we see those disparity rates. That's why we see the educational problems. The achievement gap is... For the American Indian community is the second worst in the nation. And most people in the state of Minnesota don't know that, but that was quoted to me from somebody in House Research. We have the second worst achievement gap in the nation, in the American Indian community. And that is something that the entire state of Minnesota, since we deal with public education and the majority of our kids are publicly educated, well, we have to work on that. So how are we going to find ways to work on this, perhaps as a supplement? And to supplement, I am of a firm belief that if we continue to come together as a state agency and with the state of Minnesota and having these bodies and these people present together as a collective whole, if we continue to come to the table as we are in our current structure, we can continue to solve the problems that the state of Minnesota feels in the American Indian community. So perhaps a day will come. I'm not sure. But right now, it is a way to solve, and a very good way to solve problems.
Members, we need to move on in order to have adequate time for all the other presentations we have. So thank you very much for being here today and giving us your story.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, the Chicano Latino Affairs Council. Welcome, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. I'm Hector Garcia. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Chicano Latino Affairs Council. Thank you for inviting me to do a presentation of our council before you, Chair Lanning, and members of the committee. I was hired for this position back in October of 2009, and I come from the financial sector, where I was Vice President of International and Domestic Emerging Markets for Wells Fargo Bank Private Client Services, and was also Mexico Liaison for the Prudential Base Securities Company in New York, and Executive Director of Minnesotans for NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. I mentioned that background because it's pertinent to some of the things that I'll be talking about in just a few minutes. I feel very conscious of the serious challenges that are faced by the state in its budget and its economy. And besides doing a presentation, as I was requested to do, of the agency and its budget, if there is time available, I'd like to make a few suggestions on how we might be of help in addressing some of those challenges. So with that, I'd like to point to you the mission of the agency is to offer recommendations to the Minnesota governor and legislature on issues of importance to the Latino community in the state, and to serve as a liaison between state government and the Latino community. We publicize the accomplishments of the Latino community, and that has been one of our main areas of focus in our relationship with the Humanities Center and the Legacy Fund. Next, you see the organizational development of our agency, how we begin by having civic engagement forums and focus groups in different parts of the state with the Latino community to gather their opinions, their interests, and their concerns, and then analyze that data through studies that we do either independently or in collaboration with other entities, and then bring them to your attention at the legislature and also to the governor's office, sometimes making recommendations for new bills. And ultimately, the intent of this whole process is to bring about collaboration between the Latino community and state government, as well as with the majority community. Our focus at this point in time, in view of the challenges that I just mentioned, we are trying to reduce the disparities among our community members in the areas of economic development and education in order to generate more short and long-term revenue for the community and for the state. We continue to promote the approval of the job training bill, House File 645, and continue to develop collaborative work with other councils, foundations, and the state in general, as well as corporations and educational institutions, and motivating members of our community and institutions in order to come up with a strategic way of addressing the achievement gap in education, which is a serious concern to everyone. As you know, we have the lowest rate of graduation of any group in the state. We continue to develop with the other councils a new image of the Latino and other minority communities, which might lead to greater partnership interaction between them and yourselves, as well as the majority community. I think this is a pivotal point, and I'll come back to address it in just a few minutes. We continue also making efforts to generate funding from corporations and foundations to complement what we get from the state. Next, you see the clusters of Latino populations throughout the state. The largest number of Latinos reside in the metropolitan area, but our percentage here is small in comparison to places like Worthington, where we're over 10% of the population. The map to your left also points out those clusters, and on the right-hand side there's a pie chart showing you where the Latinos come from. As you know, we have a large proportion of immigrants, which is also very pertinent to some of the things that I'll be saying in a few minutes. Most of us are Mexican. I myself am a Mexican immigrant from Mexico City. I was fortunate enough to come here with a degree in business administration and to speak English and French, because my family was able to send me to France, Canada, the U.S., and other countries to study. So unfortunately, the majority of the immigrants that come to Minnesota are not quite that fortunate. As you probably know, the majority are poor and have a low level of education. Not everyone, you know, there's quite a few that have come with degrees. In the area of economic development, we put together for you a set of statistics which are very impressive. I believe in 2007 there were 5,000 Latino-owned firms in Minnesota, which shows a 25.8 increase from the number of Latino companies in 2002. And in 2007, those firms sold more than $1.6 billion with a 248% increase from 2002. The most current figures on sales from Latino businesses, which come from the Minneapolis Foundation, show that they exceed $2 billion. And the Latino buying power is $3.3 billion in 2005, up to $4.4 billion in 2008. On the other hand, we have significant barriers. Many Latino entrepreneurs, because of their origins in poverty-stricken regions of Latin America, have little knowledge and understanding of the state and city structures and what they have to offer to them to enable them to start new businesses. We have tried to address that, among other things, by updating and translating a document from DEED, which shows Latinos who do not speak English how to start a new business. Again, you see that dramatic figure of 48% of Latino high school students graduating, which is one of our most serious challenges. We have a population of approximately 324,000, making us the most prominent minority in Minnesota, and our age, which is also very, very important. Median age is 24 compared to the majority population of 40. We have a workforce participation rate of 83.8, which is the highest of any ethnic group in Minnesota. On the other hand, we have a very high rate of unemployment, 15.5%, compared to the 7% for the whole state. And then if you look at this screen on education, you again see that very worrisome 48% figure and projections of reaching the levels of graduation in 2025 that will be par with the majority community. We point out some of the root causes of these low performance rates in education and some actions that we have been taking to try to remedy the situation, not directly because we don't do educational programs, but we do convene and we are a catalyst and we motivate other institutions to do that work with us. As an example of that, the Office of Higher Education has worked with us a great deal last year in starting pilot projects in different high schools such as Hopkins. How we would address the 15% and 20% reduction that was requested from us is that obviously it will impact our capacity to perform our activities primarily in outreach to other places in Minnesota. Traveling would have to be reduced. We would also have to reduce the number of staff from 4 individuals to 3. We currently have a legislative research analyst who is here, Davis Pinoza. We have an administrative and financial assistant, Gladys Rodriguez, right here as well. Our community relations manager is ill today, so she wasn't able to come. Astrid, who is originally from Colombia. So we would have to eliminate one of the 4 positions, and in the case of the 15% reduction, we would operate with 2 full-time employees and 1 part-time staff working 60 hours per pay period. In the case of the 20% reduction, we would have to operate with 3 part-time employees, 2 working 72 hours per day, per period, and 1 working 60 hours per pay period. Next, you see the budget overview, the current one, and the governor's recommendation. I was informed by the budget officer that the 0.5% reduction that you see to your right is simply a result of the adjustment that was made to the recommendation of our lowering our full-time employees to 3.1. It was not actually a recommendation that our budget be reduced. So with that, I'd like to move on to those suggestions that I said I would have for your consideration in how I believe we could help in addressing the challenges that the state faces. In addition,
Mr. Garcia, yes. We only have a couple of minutes left here, so if you want to give committee members an opportunity to ask you any questions, we'll
sure,
have to.
Certainly.
Representative Hayden.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair, to the testifier. So I'm looking at your budget recommendations, and you were, or what would happen if you took 15 to 20% reduction? I guess what I didn't hear or see is any of the backroom functions that you could collaborate with the other councils, things like, you know, sharing a staff to welcome people to your center, or sharing in collaborating and collapsing all of the councils into one office, and sharing in the rent and all of those kinds of things. Can you help me understand if I've missed that and you've gone over that scenario? It's something that I know has been on the table with all of the councils, and it's a question that I would ask all of you guys that operate with the councils. Is there a way that you can share resources in order to absorb some of these reductions?
Mr. Garcia.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe you all are aware that last year there was an attempt to bring the four councils together under one roof in order to save some money. The study was done by the Department of Administration, and the results was that there would be no savings. I should mention also that, as far as I know, there was no investigation done on private space. It was all state office space. So I don't know what the result would be of the possibility of being brought together in a private office building. As far as consolidating our operations, last year the presentations that we all made indicated that we have some concerns in terms of language, for example, particularly the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans and the Council on Black Minnesotans, and our own have some requirements for language proficiency that might make it difficult to, for example, have one administrative person receptionist. It can be done. I suspect if a study were to be done again, equipment could definitely be consolidated with no problem. There's some areas of confidentiality that would also need to be protected, but you know, anything can be done.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hayden.
And I'm sorry, I wasn't on the committee last year, so I know that, but I kind of followed this a bit, and so, you know, I think it would be important to see that study. Mm-hmm. I think it would be important to look at all of the options on the table. I understand some of the language issues with the Asian Pacific and the Chicano Latino affair. I don't think I understand the language issues with the Council of Black Minnesotans, frankly. Black Minnesotans typically speak English just like I do. So
there are African members of the.
I understand that, but I'm not sure that the staff speaks all of the different languages of Africans and the thing. But I'll allow Mr. Collins to respond to that at this time. I do think that that is something that we should look at. I think that some of these issues, and frankly, I don't understand the issues around confidentiality. If you are all employees of the state and are able to be professional, I don't know what confidentiality issues what would happen, because you would be bound by the same practices for each of the councils. So I guess this isn't really as much of a question to you, but to say that I think that that needs to be seriously considered. Otherwise, I'm not sure that you guys are going to be able to deliver the work that you need to do for the state of Minnesota if we don't look at a serious breaking down of the silos and figuring out where you can work together in order to really deliver the services that I think that people of color in this state need. So I would push you, and I'm sorry, I just lost your name right at the top. I don't want to be... Mr. Garcia, to really, and the other councils, to really look at this in a much different way and pull down some of the resistance that I know that has been there to figure out how you can work together in order to make sure that people of color are heard in this state. So I would really challenge you to look at this much different, because I think that you're going to see reductions on both sides that are going to significantly hamper your ability to do your work if you don't think about doing it differently.
Mr. Chair,
thank you, Mr. Garcia.
Representative Hayden, I don't think that there was resistance the last time that the study was done. I at least collaborated fully with the consultants that did the study, and we'd be more than willing to collaborate again. I simply pointed out some of the reasons why it was decided that it was not feasible to bring about that consolidation. I actually made a proposal to the state that we move to a private space with a savings, and HERA gave us a discount because we were considering that option. So we will do whatever is necessary to work with your committee and with whomever you assign to do a new study.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Stensrud, quickly, then we need to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll pass. He's answered some questions.
Okay. Mr. Garcia, thank you for being here this morning. And if you have some suggestions that you'd like to give to us regarding the state's overall situation, we'd be happy to receive those from you in writing. I'm sorry we don't have time to get into that today, but
I understand, and I will be glad to send it to you in writing. I think you will find it quite intriguing. Let me just say that it will connect very well with the Metropolitan Business Plan that has been presented to you by CEO Baker from Ecolab, Mayor Coleman, and Charlie Weaver. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Garcia. Next, we'll call forward the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. And while we're waiting for her to come up, I understand that former State Representative Bob Hawkes is here. Welcome. Back over here. Can't see him. Welcome to our committee, State Government Finance. Please identify yourself for the record.
Sure. Mr. Chair, my name is Eileen Herr, and I'm the Executive Director for the State Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. And sitting on my right is Brian Cao, and he is the legislative researcher person in my office, and he's here to answer questions if I get too nervous. You have a folder in front of you. One is our biennium report, which is very wordy, I don't expect you to have read or to look at it at this time. But I do want to draw your attention to the PowerPoint that I will be going through right now, and it looks like this. And I will start off first by saying that we are a state agency created as an advisory board in 1985. To do primarily 15 mandates, but those mandates can be put into three broad categories. One is to advise the governor and members of the legislature on issues pertaining to Asian Pacific Minnesotans, to advocate on issues of importance to the Asian Pacific community, and to act as a broker between the Asian Pacific community and the mainstream society. The next page is our organizational chart. We have a board that is appointed by the governor and goes through the appointment process with the Secretary of State. We have an executive director and staff. I should say staff. I have one full-time research person, a part-time office assistant, hopefully a part-time management analyst, and someone who's doing cultural programs in my office that is funded through the legacy funds. I'm going to go briefly through our three areas of focus. The first one is to be advisor to policymakers. And as such, we are a nonpartisan, hopefully credible and trustworthy source of information on the Asian Pacific community. And we are a free resource to the state of Minnesota, to the people of Minnesota, to legislators, and to members of the cabinet and the governor. In our role as advisor within the last two years of the biennium, we've done some work, but I've highlighted a few here. One is that we have vigorously worked on the issue of economic development and workforce, and that with the downturn of the economy that has severely impacted our community, and how can we engage with them to get them employed, retrained, and reemployed so that they can be a contributing taxpayer to this state. Two is that we've worked on the issue of achievement gap and graduation rate, and that is an issue of concern, in that the dropout rate for Asian American students is 25%. And when I tell kids this, I mean, if you have four friends, one of you is not going to graduate high school. How does that make you feel? And all the kids are not happy because they look at each other, four really good friends, and they get really upset about that. And the question is, then what can we do about it together? So we don't want to see anyone fail. We want everyone to be successful as much as they can, because with just a high school diploma, your earning potential over your lifetime is so much more significant than if you had not graduated from high school. And we want that for our community and for our children. We've worked on the issue of early education. And when I talk about role as advisor, this is working with either with legislators on these issues and helping you craft legislation and policy, or working directly with a state agency and department on developing policies around these issues. And just to highlight, working on the issue of eliminating health disparity, that's a big issue for the state of Minnesota. That's something that we take very seriously. Issue of public safety, and then arts and cultural heritage. Second is our role as advocate. We really want to be the voice of the community, in that yesterday we had a great Asian Day at the Capitol. We had more than 150 youth came from three different high schools. It was amazing, because usually we're not successful at getting young people to the Capitol. Normally it's adults, workers, professionals. And I asked this student, why did you come today? Why did you spend money on a bus? Take your time to come. They're like, because this year we can feel that cuts are coming our way. We're going to lose after-school programs. We're going to lose support systems at our schools that are going to help us. We're going to lose parent liaison that helps our parents to integrate and to talk and to help us in the school system. And so we feel that, and we feel we have to come to the Capitol and make our voices heard. And that's a role that the council plays. And they're like, we don't really know how to talk to legislators, but we hope that we can come to you, and through you, we can work on these issues. And I'm like, yes, that's great. That's what we want to do. We want an empowered and informed citizenry. In our role as advocate, we've done a couple of things. We usually, every year, we do an advocacy training. We do leadership training. We also focus on organizational training and capacity building, in that we have tons of nonprofits in the state of Minnesota that serves the Asian American Pacific community. We work with them to develop their boards, develop their leadership, so that they can work on civic engagement and that they can take on strong leadership roles in their neighborhoods, at their schools, in their communities. The third role is the role of bridge builder. And in that, and this is a little bit fun, in that we get to be creative. And so as you can see here, we've partnered with the Guthrie Theater on producing a play talking about sex trafficking in the community, but how it has impacted the community. So this is a story of the sex industry in Cambodia, and how it has impacted and has consequences even in Minnesota. One of the highlights that we have is we do participate and convene the community together to do a Dragon Festival, which celebrates the arts and cultural history of Asian Pacific Minnesotans. And we bring the dragon boats that you can see here that are traditional boats that are raised in Southeast or in Asia. And we bring it and we race it on Lake Phalen. And it's beautiful. And this is a way for a second or third generation Asian Americans to learn and to see some of the sites that their parents or grandparents would have seen in their home countries. And then one of the things that we're very proud of is that we do honor the contributions of outstanding Asian Pacific Minnesotans by the awarding of our annual Asian Pacific Leadership Award, which we do in May as part of celebrating May as Asian Pacific American Heritage Month. We have a strategic plan that the board has put together on how we will address the major issues within the community for the next, couple of years. We started in 2009, and it's a five-year strategic plan, and we're in our third year of that. And then lastly, I did want to address that we did receive funding from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund to help and to work with the Asian Pacific American community around what are the cultural heritage that they want to pass on to their children. And the money that we've received, we put it into like three piles. One is to do a video project that captures the stories of Asian Pacific Minnesotans. So we've been able to do a video project on the Asian Indian immigration story, the story of Japanese World War II servicemen, capturing their experience, particularly at Fort Snelling, and their critical role in the intelligence and language gathering, and then working with teenage Asian Americans on growing up Asian American. The second part of that money goes into arts and cultural programs, which are monthly events, and the third piece goes into capacity building. In that, I'll just use my own example. I was born in Laos. I'm Hmong. My family came to America when I was seven as war refugees, and as such, my parents were so busy making a living that they really didn't have time, and they didn't have the expertise to teach me about my cultural roots. So when I went to school, my friends called me refugee. I was like, oh, I'm not a refugee. And I became, I wasn't proud of that until I was in high school and in college, and I started studying what refugee meant. And refugee meant a person who was running away from persecution due to their political, religious, or social group. And I started studying, and I went, my parents, we are refugees. We should be proud of that. My parents, my father was in the CIA secret army in Laos, and he stood up for his political rights, and he stood up for his belief in democracy and freedom and independence. And because of that, we were persecuted, and we came to America. So that's something that I shouldn't be ashamed of. But that's something my parents didn't teach me, and I had to learn that on my own. And that's my own cultural heritage that I had to learn. Having learned that and having learned English and writing, I want to be able to write that down and pass it on to my generation and the generation after me. I think that's a role that is critical that our agency plays. I think that's a critical role that the state plays. And I'm very proud when I go out to my community saying that I'm from the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesota. I'm from the state of Minnesota. And they ask, where's the state in all this? Who's helping us? Who's helping us resolve all these issues? I'm like, I am, because I'm from the state. And I speak with authority. And I speak with credibility. And I'm going to bring your issues to the forefront. And we're going to focus on that. And that's what I'm here to do today. I'm here to defend my budget. There is a logical argument to our existence, and then there is an emotional argument to our existence. In 1985, our council was created at the urging of the Asian Pacific American community because they felt they didn't have a voice. They felt they didn't have a place at the table. They felt they were a foster child in America, and the parents weren't listening to them, and they fought, and the legislature heard them and said, fine, we will create a place for you at the table. You will have a state agency. We will call on them. Your issues will be heard. You will have a place at the table. This place at the table, to be really honest with you, is not even a penny of the state government budget. But with that penny, I believe I've been able to use it very successfully to be accountable for it. And I'm asking for that penny to continue to do this work with the community, which is very, very needed. Because in this, I do believe in working with the community, working to engage them, is a state duty and a state obligation. Thank you. And I will answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hurd. Thank you. Thank you for your work on behalf of your community.
Thank you.
Next, we have the Council on Black Minnesotans, Mr. Collins. Welcome, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Lester Collins. I'm the director of the State Council of Black Minnesotans. I have been the director of the council for about 22 years now. The Council on Black Minnesotans, as you'll see in the packet, at least of information that you have, is basically an organization that's been in existence since 1980, and very similar to the other councils or ethnic councils that are represented here. It essentially was created to give voice, to be a liaison, if you will, with our constituent populations. And I'll point out that that's both African and African-American in the state of Minnesota. As might be expected, as a state agency, we have statewide responsibility. We have a small staff of individuals at present. Myself as the executive director. Mr. Roger Banks, who is not here today, is our research analyst. He happens to be a slightly older gentleman than myself and is suffering some health related things. Otherwise, he would be here with me today to speak to some of the other aspects of what we do as an agency. The population, as you well know, of Africans, particularly in the state of Minnesota, has continued to grow. And one of the challenges we face is trying to work to represent and to be a voice, obviously, for that growing community as well as our own. Among the activities that we carry on continue to be what I call those greatest challenges in our community, and that is economic development. It is the achievement gap and many of the things that the other councils have spoken to. One of the things I do want to point out is that we have continued and I think worked very hard to collaborate with one another and to work on issues. We've done that with many of the individuals that are in this room, and certainly as it relates to the Senate with legislators there in terms of the education gap and other related areas. Another area that we are working on, and we'll be dealing with a bill later this afternoon, just dealing with job creation, which continues to be a challenge within our community in terms of employment, but also developing entrepreneurs, because as you all know, it is really within that small business sector or that employment area, I think, that job creation will come. So we continue to work in that area. I'm a bit reluctant to, given that our charge and duties are very similar as relates to the councils. Again, many of the areas, the achievement gap, I can tell you that some of the things that the council has done, usually we try to serve as incubators for our community in terms of addressing needs. For instance, among those is the Office of Minority Health. The council actually was one of the brainchilds in terms of the creation of that department, because as we dealt with health-related concerns, we just found that we didn't have the expertise nor the time to be able to devote to that area. So some years ago, as many of you are aware, we proposed legislation in conjunction with the Department of Health to create what is the Office of Minority Health. Another area is that of adoption and foster care, which continue to be a challenge and will continue to be a challenge for our community given the economic times in terms of the stresses on family, particularly as it relates to divorces, job loss, and all, and for that matter, housing loss and those kinds of areas. So we created or helped create some years ago, I think approximately 17 years ago now, what is called the African-American Adoption Agency in the state of Minnesota, which addresses those issues. There was a time when many of the children within our community, that is black children or children of color, were essentially being placed everywhere but within what I call their family systems. They were essentially being placed in rural and suburban areas outside of their immediate family systems. Relatives weren't being considered for placement in their homes. And it essentially, what I call, we were financing what would be homes that were other than, say, grandparents, mothers, brothers, etc. Many of those things have changed, and I think we played a very crucial role in that particular regard. One of the big challenges at present is, again, the achievement gap, and as spoken to in each one of the communities that have gone before me, it continues to be a challenge. We work on those issues collaboratively. I think we're beginning to make some progress, not only locally, although we have much to do, but I'm glad at least that the national focus is such that the achievement gap is being addressed in terms of remedies, and we're working on those issues as it stands. Another area of responsibility that we assume, I'm guessing now, about 15, 20 years ago, was the celebration of the King holiday in Minnesota, and many of you have attended that event. Usually it's about 3,000 to 4,000 people that attend that event. The one of the things I want to point out, our budget, which kind of reflects roughly about $300,000 and some change, about $20,000, $25,000 of that amount is spent on the King celebration. And by the way, the King celebration cost about $40,000 to administer and do. And by the way, we do raise the other portion of those dollars in terms of the celebration. Why is that celebration important? I would say that it's important locally as it relates to this race relationships, as it relates to, I think, as it relates to even world conditions. And I mean around the world, as I look at remedies in terms of addressing how we're going to exist as a people within both this state and within this country, and for that matter, within this world, I think that some of the King principles in terms of nonviolence and the fact that indeed we are our brother's keepers is one of the challenges that that we think that the importance of the King celebration kind of represents, remind us. And by the way, I happen to be the chairperson of the King celebration. You have the brochure in your midst. And by the way, that committee is Jewish, Europeans, blacks, young people, and others, and we think that it serves as an instrument in terms of, again, helping having some harmony within this state and around the state. The cultural funds have been spoken of, and my thanks to many in this room, particularly Representative Murphy, in terms of her insight, in terms of making dollars available to the councils. Many of them have spoken to what is called the absent narratives, or if you will, allowing us as communities of color, the Native American community, in terms of who we are, our contributions to the state, and they have been many, not only in this state, but in this country. Those narratives, I think, will help as it relates to our young people. I think it will contribute as it relates to even the so-called education gap. I can tell you in my own life, it was only as I discovered that indeed my ancestors were inventors and kings and queens, and had a large part of not only shaping the world, but also contributions in terms of this state and the United States for that matter. So we think it's important that those stories be told in terms of those contributions. It also is a part of our responsibilities to publish those accomplishments within our community, and the legacy funds have helped to do that. One of the things that I will speak to that we have done with those funds, two primary things, one in the African community, is a piece called the Bunce Island exhibit, which will be coming here, in terms of just the contributions and the role of slavery, but even more importantly, the accomplishments that have occurred since that time. We are contributing a large portion of money to that. The other is an issue that has come before the legislature in general, and that is the Minnesota African American Museum. I think that is important, again, in terms of the contributions that have been made both locally, primarily, and nationally, that somewhere that history be archived, be able to be experienced, seen, and if you will, touched. And we contribute a fairly large sum of money to that museum in terms of getting it started, and again, to, if you will, publish and to keep the many treasures and tell the story of African and African-Americans in the state of Minnesota. As it relates to budget in terms of reduction, again, one of the things that the council, as I said, is myself as the director. I have a research analyst. I have an administrative secretary. And also in my office, that is the extent of the council's staff. We also have been fortunate enough to have received for the last several years money from Blue Cross Blue Shield, which started out as also dollars from NPAP, which is now Clearway. So our budget also reflects those kind of dollars in terms of smoking cessation and education. We believe that with the proliferation of smoking, particularly its contribution to other health-related concerns, particularly diabetes and other related concerns, that the elimination of those as contributing factors in terms of the health of our community. So we've been successful in terms of attaining those dollars from them, and they do help. Young lady that happens to head that, Ms. Natalie Lee Johnson, has done, I think, a fine job, and we've been, again, I think because of the work that we've done in that area, successful at moving into what is a contract relationship with Blue Cross Blue Shield. In terms of meeting the budget reductions and that have been put before us, essentially for us, what it means is that the research analyst that I spoke of that is not here today, who is at about 60%, will be reduced to about halftime, and we will make changes as we need to in terms of supplies and other areas. As I mentioned, in terms of our relationship with other councils, I would say that one thing I work pretty hard at, and I'd like to give Hector's still here, I think as the newest director among us, I think he works very hard in terms of consulting, but also trying to encourage us to work and collaboratively together. We do that pretty much on a monthly basis where we meet, if not more frequently. And again, later on today, we'll be testifying together as it relates to some job creation legislation and some other things that he was not able to speak of and that I'm not going to take the time to go in terms of our contributions, I think, in the area of tourism and economic development. But that's stuff that we could share later. I think with time being the issue, and the information that I have before you, I'll certainly open the floor, if it's okay, to questions that you might have of me.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Collins, last year you received $250,000 in legacy funding.
Yeah.
And just wondering if that, I mean, you mentioned narratives and some other things that you used the money for. Was any of that money left over?
Mr. Collins.
Mr. Chair, we still do have money. I wouldn't say left over. We're still in the process. In fact, we just had a meeting this past Friday where we were reviewing proposals that we had just received, where we are looking at, I think we are looking at maybe three additional proposals. I don't anticipate that we'll have any dollars left over. In fact, our major challenge at this particular point, I think we have at present, as I sit here and talk to you now, about $78,000 of $250,000, and we have, I'm guessing, about 20 proposals on the table. We just reviewed about 11 of them. We won't be able to, meet, that obligation or those proposals, and they're very good proposals, so I don't anticipate having any money essentially on the table or left that we won't expend. In fact, we're looking at how we might partner and help otherwise.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Collins, in 2008, there was a legislative auditor's financial audit done. I'm just wondering what, because of the findings, their concerns about the way your council was working, documenting payroll and things. What's been done since that to correct some of those findings?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Representative, one of the things that we have done is we formed at that particular time an additional arm of the community. We have of the council. We have a treasurer now who handles and works with me on a monthly basis. We report on a quarterly basis to the council. But just looking closer, even in some collaboration even with other councils in terms of their handlings along those lines, I think we pretty much remedied any concerns in terms of some of the issues that were cited or looked at. We presented remedies, you know, to them as they were brought to us. I don't think that those will be things that we will see as we move forward, or should we be audited at this particular point. So.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has the auditors come back to discuss this with you?
Since Mr. Collins?
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to. There was a follow-up, discussion that was that did occur. We have not been, I don't believe, audited since that particular time, as I can recall. There was a point where we were audited twice, kind of by what is called the Internal Audit Division, and then some other audit. It just happened that we happen to have two closely related audits. But no discussion or concern. There are some records or things that we weren't quite keeping that I'm more than aware that we have at present, been doing. That would be the best that I can answer.
Thank you.
Members, we need to move on. Representative Slawick, quickly.
Mr. Chair, I would like to ask this question. And this is regarding, there was federal legislation regarding forming early childhood advisory councils throughout all of the states. So as I was the chair, we were in the majority, we asked all the councils to nominate folks for the early childhood advisory council. And some of you all did, and some of you nominated your staffs, which I was thought was sort of interesting. But since then, one thing that happened is Governor Plenty appointed none of the people that were nominated from the councils. And the Early Childhood Advisory Committee has been criticized for not having representatives from the communities of color. So it's not been good. That being said, Governor Dayton is going to issue a new executive order authorizing a new Early Childhood Advisory Council. This is about closing the achievement gap. So I hope all of you will get your applications in as soon as possible, because that is supposed to be announced shortly. And my quick question would be, are you working with Governor Dayton to increase folks from the communities of color on the various appointments that he's making? Because we found that we sought out, we had to seek people out, and we still weren't able to do that. Is that going better with this governor?
Mr. Chair, Representative,
Mr. Collins.
I assure you, not only are we looking at that particular council, but any number of others. One of our concerns is the representation on other councils and commissions, period, throughout the state. So one of our primary objectives is increasing those numbers. We think it's one of the best ways. I mean, it's easy. Well, no. I didn't mean to say that at all. It's difficult monitoring legislation and trying to change it. It is much easier to be on a commission, to be working with a rule, to be advising. So we think that strategically it's one of the best moves in terms of the councils that we can make in terms of that kind of expertise in our community. I think we will more than make sure that the early childhood development area is staffed or has individuals. And by the way, I would much rather come from the community. We're pretty staffed, challenged at this particular point. So, and in answer, Mr. Chair, also to your question, I think working with this particular governor in terms of not only appointments to our boards, because there have been times for each one of these councils where we have gone literally, when I say months, I mean several months without full complement of minister of our councils, which you can imagine hurt in many respects. So I'm encouraged, at least with the communication we're having with his office in that particular regard in terms of appointments.
Representative Stensrud, quickly, and then
thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Collins, just to follow up kind of with Representative Hayden's ideas, where do you fit in? Who does your payroll? I can't figure out which department might be doing that for you, or do you do your own, and like your phone service, because you're in a separate location, but I just wasn't sure how the billing works for that. Could you shed some light on that? Thank you.
Mr. Collins?
Mr. Chair, again, after 22 years, I certainly, the way I would answer the question is that we handle it, essentially ourselves. Finances are decentralized in that, fiscal services, we receive the bills, we send them, they pay them in that particular regard. We are on the state, system, I think similar to what you are, any other state agency, our emails and all those kinds of, so very similar, if not the same, in that particular regard.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. Appreciate your being here.
Can I say this? One concern I do have, you can imagine also we occasionally, because we are state, wide agencies, I'm assuming that other councils also occasionally, because we're making trips as a whole council, it's much more economical to do so by use of, say, renting a van. Right now that happens to be Enterprise. I can tell you one of the concerns that I do have. I understand we do purchase as a state, on volume and probably discounts in terms of insurance and all those kinds of things. But I can tell you that it does concern me that I do know that we could rent for much less on our own than going through many of the services that we do use. So if that helps at all, I can tell you to pay 34 when I could pay 17, but I realize that we're talking about many other agencies doing the same, so it does concern me often that I see where we could save money and not able to do so under the present system.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. Yep. Appreciate it. We need to move on to the State Arts Board.
Thank you.
And we have another former member of the House who will be joining us. Former Representative Mike Sharon, who also now comes before us wearing the hat of Chair of the State Arts Board.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, and please identify yourself officially for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mike Sharon. I'm currently the Dean for the School of the Arts at St. Mary's University in Winona, Minnesota. And currently in my second year as chair of the Minnesota State Arts Board. It is good to see many of you again. It's good to recognize a lot of familiar faces. I see that the face of Representative Simon has not aged a day. I like to tell people that I was only up here in the legislature long enough to have a cup of coffee, but it was one of the best cup of coffees I've ever had. As a former member of this body, I do understand the difficult decisions that you're going to need to make regarding the budget. And I have no qualms as a fiscal conservative coming before you today to say that I believe that the State Arts Board is a good investment of the state's dollars. I accepted Governor Pawlenty's appointment in 2008 because of my belief in that. The general fund appropriation that the state of Minnesota is making to the State Arts Board in this year is $8.3 million. When I left in 2006, that appropriation was $8.6 million a year. In terms of the whole budget, this represents 3/100ths of a percent of the state budget. And to many people, that sounds like a very small and insignificant amount of our state budget. But it is my very strong feeling that this is a vital and an important investment in our state's economy. The arts are a $1 billion business. Now, I'm just talking to the nonprofit arts, are a $1 billion business here in the state of Minnesota. To kind of put that in a national perspective, there's a lot of talk right now about the NFL and the big business that it is. It's making a lot of headlines. I'm a season ticket holder for the Vikings. You know, I want my NFL, and I might not get it. Some of the figures they bounce around are the NFL's, some people say, $11 billion business. Some people say $22 billion business. The arts in the United States is a $166 billion with a B dollar business. The return in tax revenue nationally to the federal government is $29.6 billion. $9.1 billion are going to state agencies in tax revenue, and $7.9 billion are going to local revenue. What does this mean to somebody like me from Winona? I come from a town of only about 26,000 people. It's a very art-centric business climate in Winona. The average patron who comes and buys a ticket to an arts event in Winona spends $27.79 over and above the cost of the ticket. If somebody's coming from out of town, it's $40.19 per person is spent above and beyond the ticket to the event. That's huge for us in Winona because 50% of our audiences come from out of town. I'm also a lifelong educator. I'm glad to see that Representative Erdahl is still representing the folks in Atwater, my first teaching job in their public high school there. It's good to see you still here.
It's good to be here.
Young people who are involved in the arts score 100 points higher on the SAT exam. 100 points higher. Now, as we look at the world economy, I know most of you have read The World is Flat. We know that we're not going to be able to compete with the Chinese economy for numbers or the Indian economy for price. We here in America have always gotten moved forward because we were the most innovative and the most creative. And I can think of no better place for young people of all, I'd say that for all ages, to learn just those type of skills. I accepted Governor Pawlenty's appointment because I believe investing in the arts makes good sense for the state of Minnesota. And the Arts Board, along with our state regional arts councils, provide for this state the most transparent, effective, and rigorous way of delineating our state funds for this economic resource. I'm now going to turn it over to my colleague at the State Arts Board, Sue Jentz.
Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record, Ms. Jentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Sue Jentz. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board. I have the great pleasure of working for Mr. Chiron and the other members of our board. I was here about a month ago, and I gave you an overview of our agency, so I won't go back and repeat what I shared with you then. What we'll do today is focus more on our budget. We'll talk a bit about the governor's recommendation for our general fund for the 12-13 biennium, and then we'll also talk with you about what those investments are being used for and what the impact of those dollars are throughout the state of Minnesota. And you have a handout. I'll get to that in just a second. I wanted to begin by highlighting two things that I think help put our budget and our work in context. Firstly, the Minnesota State Arts Board is a state agency, as Mr. Chiron said. We were created more than 100 years ago by the legislature. Then and now, our purpose was to stimulate and encourage the creation, the performance, and appreciation of the arts in the state. State statute tells us that's what we are meant to do. We're not a single organization, though, as Mr. Chiron pointed out. We are an enterprise made up of a board and 11 regional arts councils working in partnership, and we serve as the fiscal agent for those boards. We don't represent a single art form, a single type of arts discipline, a specific audience, or one community or region. We represent the state of Minnesota. We are a public system that serves all individuals, organizations, and counties in the state. Secondly, the funds that we receive from the state of Minnesota don't enrich our organization. They don't enrich any of the regional arts councils independently. We don't produce plays. We don't write books. We don't present concerts. The funds that we receive benefit those that we serve. Nearly all of the dollars that we receive, we turn around as grants to individuals and to organizations throughout the state of Minnesota. And so really, when you see the three of us or the five of us eventually here at the table, what you see behind us is more than 1,000 arts organizations, tens of thousands of individual artists, hundreds of community arts schools, public schools, colleges, and university art programs, countless community festivals and fairs, arts councils, human service organizations all across the state who are presenting arts programming. And for 100 years, the state has recognized the value of those organizations and has used the Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils as its mechanism for distributing funds. I'm going to point now to the handout that you have, and it is very brief, so we'll take questions at the end if you'd like. The first page is a summary of our general fund appropriations. We gave you about 15 years of data, just so you'll have that. In the very right-hand column, you'll see the governor's budget proposal for fiscal 12 and 13. This year, this biennium, fiscal 10 and 11, we're receiving about $8.3 million per year, as Mr. Sharon said, 16.7 for the biennium. And the governor is proposing a 5% reduction for fiscal 12 and 13, down to $15.8 million. One of the things that I think, I hope you'll see as you look down at the graph below, which obviously reflects the numbers above, is that the Arts Board's funding from the general fund peaked right around the 1998 through 2003. In 2004, when the state was facing a $4.5 billion deficit, our funding was cut by a third. And you'll see that other than the spike in 2008-2009, the general fund investment has been going down. And interestingly enough, I know that there are many who are concerned about perhaps out of control spending or growth on automatic pilot. I don't think that's true for the Arts Board. In fact, in the 15 years of data that you see here, our overall, from 1996 to where we are today, the growth would be about 15% or 1% per year. So this is an agency that has been small and managed its resources as well as it possibly can. The second page that we've given you is not something that really is this committee's purview. We made our funding request to the Legacy Division just a week ago in Chairman Erdahl's committee. We wanted to give this to you just because it is part of our budget and part of what we do. Our legacy funding request for the year is $52.5 million to be spent on the three primary areas that are in the Constitution, arts and arts access, arts education, and arts and cultural heritage. And then the last thing I'd like to leave you with is the final page, which just gives you a sense of the need that we are trying to respond to. It's a summary of our fiscal 10 and 11 requests, both for the Regional Arts Councils and for the Arts Board. Requests increased by 86%. The dollars requested increased by more than 300%. We know that there is a great deal of interest. There is a great deal of activity taking place in the state of Minnesota, and we've really been pleased to be the agency that helps this body and the state make wise investments for those funds. I'm going to hand off now to Maxine Adams from one of our regional arts councils, who will talk a little bit more about how those funds are being invested.
Welcome, Ms. Adams, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Maxine Adams. I'm the director of the Lake Region Arts Council based in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, and we serve nine counties in west central Minnesota. Let me speak briefly to how those general funds are used through the Regional Arts Council system. The general fund dollars are really the bedrock of the state arts programming in our 87 counties. Through this funding, we invest in our state's most important creative assets. We strengthen the artistic product and the professional capacity of creative people and organizations who in turn create, produce, and present works of art and arts programs and activities that Minnesotans demand. This funding develops and replenishes our creative resources. It ensures that there are high-quality arts programs and activities in every part of the state, and it makes sure that these programs are affordable to all Minnesotans. Hundreds of arts organizations across the state are sustained by this support. The list of the grantees is long and impressive. For instance, it includes nationally renowned organizations like the Children's Theater Company and the Walker Arts Center. These both are based in the cities, but serve a statewide audience through their education and outreach activities. Regional arts centers like the Rife Center in Grand Rapids and the Rochester Arts Center are able to present artists and works of art from across the country and, in fact, the world, thanks to state support. Without these organizations and the public support they receive, Minnesotans might not otherwise be able to see and experience these kinds of artists and art forms. Local arts organizations like Albert Lee's Arts Center, the Dassel-Cocato Arts Association, Fairmont Opera House, the Fargo-Moorhead Area Youth Symphonies, the Jaques Arts Center in Aiken, John Hassler Theater in Plainview, and the West Bank School of Music in Minneapolis all receive support to offer exhibitions, concert plays, workshops, classes, and other activities in their home communities, featuring work by exceptionally talented and local and regional artists. I'd also like to give you an example from my arts council of a young lady, Melissa, from the Detroit Lakes area. We use our general fund dollars to support an artist mentor program where high school students can study intensively over their summer with either an artist or attend an arts workshop. These students are chosen by a very rigorous audition and interview process. And last year, after we announced who the winners were, I received a phone call in my office from one of the moms. And she wanted to tell me how much this meant to Melissa. Melissa had very slight autism, and she said, you know, my daughter's really struggled. She's teased a lot at school about being different. She usually seeks refuge in her drawing. And I wish you could have seen her face when she came home to tell me that she had been awarded a scholarship. As her mom, I am so very, very proud of her. And I just wanted you to know that you have really made a difference in our lives. Now, I don't get those kind of phone calls all the time, but once in a while I do. And it really carries home to me, at least, how much the arts not only produce plays and musical performances, but on occasion really do touch somebody's life very deeply. This money means a lot in our communities. And as Sue Jens had said earlier, we have provided a copy of the request that we have presented to the Legacy Fund Division last week, simply to give you a sense of the ways that we invest the legacy funds to supplement the core support that we receive from our base funding. These funds are used primarily to expand or enhance the kind of arts activities that are available in the state and to give Minnesotans more opportunities to participate in the arts. Now, this afternoon, I'll be driving home to Fergus Falls. We have a project grant round that uses our base appropriation dollars, and we'll be reviewing 23 grants from a variety of arts organizations in our area. Who will do that reviewing are the members of our board, who are ordinary, everyday citizens. We have farmers, we have retired university professors, we have artists, we have high school music teachers. It's really a broad representation of our communities that are deciding where those dollars are spent and how they're spent. It's the citizens of Minnesota really working on the grassroots level to distribute these funds in the best way that they possibly can. They also review these. They take their job really seriously. They review these grants by very high criteria and fund only the very best. We also always receive 2 to 3 times the amount of requests that we can fund. I didn't mention everything that we do. It's a really rich and diverse system that we use to distribute the funds. But I'd also like to give you a chance to hear from one of our grantees and tell how his community and his residents who live here benefit from these funds. I thank you for your time and would like to bring up
Tony Goddard.
Tony Goddard, thank you.
Mr. Chair, with your permission.
Please identify yourself, and we need to keep it short because we only have a few minutes left here and want to give the committee a chance to ask a few questions anyway. So please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tony Goddard. I'm the executive director of the Paramount Theater and Visual Arts Center in St. Cloud. And I'm pleased to be here, and I will do my best to be brief and hit some high points here. The support of the Minnesota State Arts Board is significant to our operation in St. Cloud, particularly in that it allows us to take risks that we would not normally be able to do to bring programming to the community that otherwise might not, residents might not see. In the short term, we have a very significant economic impact on the community, and particularly the downtown. 70,000 to 80,000 visitors a year to downtown St. Cloud. We are the largest single draw in the community. We have, and again, with the State Arts Board's support, sponsored a series of art crawls. The most recent one, we had 700 patrons on site. And downtown St. Cloud is abuzz on nights when the Paramount is active. We try to keep the place very busy. There's something going on in the building about 350 days of the year. Some of that programming are shows, performances that sell well. Joan Baez, for those of you who are of my generation, if you're younger, coming Friday night, we have the Bodines. So we have a wide variety of entertainment, and we try to focus on that. The Arts Board support allows us to present acts that might not draw as large an audience as the Bodines or Joan Baez. For example, the Lakota Sioux Dance Company, an internationally known performing troupe we brought to St. Cloud in collaboration with St. Cloud State University, had a number of school shows that brought those entertainers directly to students in the community. We have coming up April 1st the Houston Ballet, again a fine art presentation that might not otherwise come to our part of the state. We also have an immediate impact on the economy, and I the other day calculated what I call the P3 report, Paramount Purchases and Payroll, and it's a simple-minded calculation of economic impact. We simply went through our books for the last fiscal year to see who we pay and calculated the geographic location of those entities. 66% of the money is respent in St. Cloud area and an additional 16% in the remainder of the state of Minnesota. So 82% of the money, in short, is turned around and paid out to merchants and individuals in the community. We also have, and this is, I think, equally important to that short-term immediate impact, is we play an important role in the long-term growth of the community. In St. Cloud, there's a growing recognition in the business and civic community that the long-term prosperity of our community depends on creativity and innovation and on the preparation of our young people for the future, and the arts are a critical part of that.
Mr. Goddard, please wrap this up okay. So we can get to a couple questions.
And thank you very much. We have a number of collaborations in the community, a Boys and Girls Club and other social service agencies. Maybe I will wrap it up there. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Move on.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Redman.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Redman, quickly, if you...
Mr. Chairman, I'll be very, very quick. Lawrence Redman, for the record, I'm representing Minnesota Citizens for the Arts. We're the field. We're organizations like the Paramount. We're the 1,400 organizations that are around the state, the 14.5 million attendances that take place in the state every year. We're the businesses, we're the citizens of the state who are dependent upon these activities. We're the kids whose lives are enhanced and built by these kinds of activities. There's a term in our vocabulary about a thankless job. I guess I can't think of a group of people who that would apply to more than the members of the legislature who have to deal with this very difficult budget. But we want you to know from every corner of this state, in every county where our organizations are, that we don't see this as a thankless thing. We're Minnesotans. We realize that you have a very difficult task in front of you. We realize that there are going to have to be budget cuts and so forth. What we ask you to consider when you look at this, though, is that there's a long history of building up a system of private and public contribution to make this system work. And that if in this moment of difficult trouble with our state's finances, if too deep a cuts are made in this, there are problems that will stay for decades to come. We understand what has to happen. We realize that. We just ask for fairness and thoughtfulness in that. I think in the long term, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there will be great thanks for this. Ironically, the great thank to you for the work that you'll do and your thoughtfulness in this won't necessarily be in the next month, in the next year, in the next election, even the next few years. It'll be 20 years out, 30 years out, when because of the good decisions and thoughtful ones that you make now, continue to create this kind of system that touches all these lives in Minnesota. We thank you for that, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr. Redman. A question I have for Ms. Jens, if you would please come forward. Ms. Jens, what happens if the funds that are provided by Legacy do not cover the full cost of implementing the programs that are being funded by Legacy? Does that then fall back on the regional arts councils or others funded by the general fund to cover the additional cost?
Mr. Chair, if I'm understanding your question correctly, it has to do with administrative costs?
Ms. Jens, the cost of implementing the programs funded under Legacy. What happens if the Legacy funds don't fully cover the cost of implementing what Legacy is funding?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, right now for the Arts Board and for the Regional Arts Councils, we are covering the costs of providing those programs and services partly through general fund dollars and partly through dollars that we are allowed to use from the Legacy Fund. There was a limit on those dollars this year. It was 2.5%, which was really quite difficult to provide the kind of service we wanted to, but we made it work for this first period around. Our grantees are also allowed to use some portion of the funds to administer their programs. Obviously, they need people to deliver services. They need teachers. They need artists. They need infrastructure. And so they're using some portion of those grants to make sure that the programs that they intend to provide to Minnesotans are that they can do those.
Well, Ms. Jens, I think this is an issue. I mean, if legacy funds are intended to be on top of, then if implementing those programs ends up costing more than what Legacy is funding, that's a problem that squeezes the rest of the budgets. So anyway, it's a question that I have, that we need to address. Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wish we had time to tell so that I can tell you more about the Paramount and what it's done in St. Cloud. It's been a wonderful place for us. But I want to just take advantage of the limited time to ask a specific question. As I see this board and what you do, I see someone acting as an agent on behalf of the state that says it has an interest in funding art. There are other places we could look at to have that agency happen. We could go down to a regional level and do it at the region level. I guess what I'm trying to get at is as a state art board, what's the value added of having you be our agent versus looking at a more regional distribution method?
Is that for Ms. Jens?
Or either of them, actually.
Or Ms. Jens, Mr. Sharon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Banyan, I'll start, and maybe Mr. Schoen would want to add on. I think the value of having both a statewide and a regional approach is that there are activities, there are programs, there are organizations that serve the entire state of Minnesota. And as the state agency, much of what we are able to fund are those larger organizations or those bigger programs that might touch a variety of regions and a variety of communities. Each of the regional arts councils is providing support for their specific geographic region. And so if let's say an organization wanted to provide programs in two or three of those regions, it would be difficult for a regional arts council to fund that. but it's something that the Arts Board could fund. So there are places where specifically local decision-making and local funding really is valuable, and there are places where the activity is such that it really needs a larger and a sort of a wider swath, if you will, and that's where the Arts Board can be effective.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Mr. Charron, yes.
I would say that in this is that all of the citizens of Minnesota are paying into our tax fund, our revenue, and a state organization run by 11 citizens, overseen by 11 citizens, appointed by the governor, oversees that we make sure that everything just doesn't happen in the metro area, or it doesn't all just go out state. So a child buying penny candy in Thief River Falls is actually contributing to this fund. The same way that a senior citizen who's in a nursing home in my community of Winona is also contributing to this fund. And I'll leave it at that. I know you're short for time.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for being here today to make the case for your budget. And members, you're reminded that we meet at 8 tomorrow morning. Set your clocks early. Meeting adjourned.